Arishuras and so forth, I will teach. I press homage to the Gautama, who out of his compassion toward the holy Dharma to rid us of distorted views. And so on this earth, all beings, sentient beings, even down to the smallest creatures, all of them want happiness and do not want suffering. There's no need to reason this out. It's something that we can see. So first I would like to say this. All other animals, regarding pain and pleasure, they experience the pain and pleasure related to the sensorial experiences, sensorial perceptions. So this is very clear. Therefore, they seek pleasure related to sensorial experiences and avoid those of the negative experiences, pain. On the sensorial level, we as human beings. As human beings, we have a special brain. But this brain also was formed through evolution. Evolutionary process has taken place about 100,000 years ago, perhaps, the cerebral, the brain part related with intelligence was smaller under the skull. But then it developed further and further, and people became, human beings have become more and more able to use our intelligence. So for human beings, of course, the sensorial experiences of pain and pleasure are important to know, but mainly those related with our mind are more serious and stronger. And perhaps for human beings, there are more. So the sensorial pain and pleasure have to do with the immediate stimuli. And there's not much thinking about future. But as human beings, because of this intelligence, we have pain and pleasure based on our future anticipation of what's going to happen to us in the future. I mean, worrying about them. And then we can also remember past experiences, and that in turn gives pain and pleasure. So I usually say this, the material development, external developments are or mostly give satisfaction on a sensorial level, and together with it they also give rise to some degree of pain and pleasure in the mind. Around 200 years ago, science developed. Not only checking in, science did not only check what we can actually see with senses, but they go deeper. And because of the scientific development, there has been technological development through which the material progress also happened. And so people, because they find the sensorial experiences of pain and pleasure seem to be more urgent, and therefore people's focus shifted to overcoming the physical pains and so in India about 3,000 years ago, And also in the Middle East, in Egypt, about maybe 4,000 or in China 5,000 years ago, there had been. So in order to overcome our shortcomings in the material things, then people began to focus more on developing on the material things. And in the past, the monasteries, everywhere in the different cultures, there was focus on studying religion and trying to give people satisfaction based on religion. But the modern education system is mostly focused on material development and not on the inner spiritual qualities, which was left to the religious groups or institutions. And in the later part of the 20th century, now in the 20th, we are in the 21st century. From our own experience, where the countries and places where there is more of a material affluence and development, where people have focused more on that, there is less of mental peace of mind. And so if your mind is disturbed, not at peace, at ease, then that in turn it disturbs our elements, the physical, bodily elements, and therefore there's all kinds of sickness and so forth. Therefore, today people are taking as interest in the inner world of mind. So to give peace of mind is something that relates to all 7 billion people. And therefore, if you have to base on one on religions, then there are many different types of religions, and there's always a complication and problem. And amongst the 7 billion people, from amongst the 7 billion people, 1 billion or more are without any belief, religious belief. And there are also human beings like us, not wanting suffering but wanting happiness. And they also have the same kind of experience of pain and pleasure due to the unruly mind. And therefore, we are looking for developing the inner peace and through education, and there's no other way than choosing education as the means to give a peace of mind. We as Buddhists make prayers for all sentient beings. We say, may all sentient beings have happiness and causes of happiness and so forth. So for other sentient beings, like animals and so forth, and then beings that may be in other galaxies or other world systems, we cannot do much. And as I said yesterday also, for the animals, that's not much we can do. And as the animals are overcome with stupidity and benightedness, and so we have to seek the means through secular ethics, which actually came to or developed in India around 3,000 years ago. So my Indian friends have told me that around that time there was some philosophical thought school called Charvaka or hedonists. And so the rest of the philosophical systems, the religious systems, or spiritual systems of India criticized that system of the Charvakas. Well, while criticizing the system, they also respected the Changsong, the sages. So So His Holiness is checking with some Dronabhacharya thing, whether Rishi, the Indian word, means a righteous one, an upright person, or sage. So what that shows is that in this noble land of India, even in those ancient times, so there is a system, or there is there was a sorry, I can't hear anything. But I would, I believe His Holiness is talking about development of the secular ethics in India in those ancient times, and even today in India, Indian constitution even is based on secularism. So we need to think about, so if we really mean by what we pray, which is the praying for all sentient beings, we need to really consider the happiness of these beings. So we need to do actually put effort in to help those 1 billion people on this earth. And so, as individuals, also we, each of us, are one of the 7 billion people. And if the if we could develop peace of mind within ourselves, it helps oneself as well as others. So we are living in this world. So if the whole world is on fire, I mean, you cannot just stay indifferent and idle. Although the fire may not have reached you yet, but since you are part of the 7 billion people, of part of this world, we as individuals need to take responsibility and take think about the whole globe. So even if you look at animals, the animals who live in community, they do not have any religious belief nor any a law or any kind of a judicial law, but they actually work in unison. They have, they take responsibility for the community. So because they need to survive, for their survival, they need to live together, help each one another. And therefore, as human beings, we must work together and work for humanity as a whole. So if we don't do that, it's quite a shame. And so, with regard to this secular ethics, the Buddha, even if the Buddha were to appear today, he would teach this, talk about it. So the Buddha's unique teaching is the selflessness, anatma principle, no soul theory. But when the Buddha taught his disciples, he also taught at some point to certain disciples as if there, when he gave teachings, he taught them as if there is some kind of a self which is separate from the body. And so if he were to appear today amongst us, he would definitely speak about secular ethics. And so all of us, all of you gathered here, each and every one of us are one of the 7 billion people. And therefore, from our own side as individuals, we could perhaps spread the message to 10 people, those 10 people could in turn spread the message to 10 each, and that makes 100, and those 100 can multiply to 1,000, and then 10,000, and 100,000, and so forth. So, as Dharma friends, those of us gathered here, we should do whatever we could, however small it may be, big or small. We should work for communities, peace of mind, to be at ease, and to practice non-violence and not harming anybody. So, regarding religion, religious faith is also because we do not want suffering and we want happiness, and so for when people have. When people met with or faced difficulties, then they found that they were not able to help themselves. Then they put their hope in something called God or some higher being. And so, when someone is really depressed, and then if you say, I mean, there is always a hope that you can put some hope in, that will help that person. And so, all of us as humans do not want suffering and want happiness. And so, the teaching of the Buddha is also meant for accomplishing happiness and overcoming suffering. So the one difference that I see is most of the religious traditions, religions on this earth, talk about all this path, this life, especially the theistic religions, those who believe in Creator, God, do not believe in past life or future life. This very life was created by the God, the Creator, and that God is seen as someone of infinite love and compassion. And so, when you understand that idea of the infinity of love in regard to God, then it really helps one. And then there are other religions which teach about past and future lives. And regarding them, since the theistic religions do not believe in past and future lives, they talk about also heaven and hell as well. And so if you do not follow the will of God, I mean, you'll go to hell, and if you follow the will of God, you'll go to heaven and so forth, are taught. But regarding the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha taught the true cessation. And if there is a possibility for us to attain this true cessation, so cessation here doesn't mean to cease. It doesn't mean that we should cease happiness, but it's about ceasing suffering. And therefore, in order to introduce us to this cessation, the Buddha taught the true suffering and true origin of suffering. And when you see that there is a possibility to overcome that suffering that the Buddha has taught, then you will have this interest and enthusiasm to attain that. So it's not like scaring you away by saying that there's suffering. So as Nagarjuna says in his Dhatnavali, that all of us want happiness, do not want suffering. And within the happiness, there is the higher realms of existence that we could achieve, and then the ultimate liberation, the definite goodness. And so as Buddhist practitioners, our temporary goal is to achieve higher rebirths. That's not the ultimate goal, but having achieved a higher rebirth, as Jerem Buche says, by what path do we overcome the samsara, and on what kind of physical basis do we do that? And so for the path, there is the understanding of selflessness. And without intelligence, there's no way you can come to understand selflessness. And therefore, we need this intelligence that is used to understand and gain insight into and experience selflessness. And so, by there is also the path that leads us to the higher rebirth. So we should not only talk about the future higher rebirths, but even in this life, if we could actually use it in a proper way, so that it is made meaningful, that also serves purpose. If you live a life swayed by jealousy, attachment, anger, and so forth, you are actually making this life less meaningful. Whereas if you have love and compassion, at the immediate level, you will have happiness. And when you think about the whole world, if you have this altruistic attitude, then it is helpful, beneficial to oneself and others. Whereas if you have a malicious thought, the state of mind, then it's no use for oneself and others. And so people who are always who create situations where they have more and more enemies will never be happy. Even at the time of their death, they will not die happily. And so on this earth, there are people who actually have killed others or who kill others without any hesitation, and they are called heroes. And these heroes, we hear that sometimes there are stories that they don't die happily. Whereas if you become friendly with others and others are friendly to you, and then you will also be able to die rather peacefully. And so the teaching of the Buddha shows the path or the means to higher rebirth and then the ultimate goal of liberation. And within liberation, there is the mere liberation from the negative emotions, the destructive emotions, and then the liberation of the higher liberation or the highest liberation of Buddhahood, which is the total freedom from all defilements in mind, both the afflictive emotions and the cognitive obscurations. And those, therefore, in order to, with regard to the higher rebirth, within the Lamrim tradition, the practices are meant for three types of beings with three types of capacities. And so the teachings pertaining to the beings with inferior or lower capacity are given certain teachings for higher rebirth, and then the teachings pertaining to the intermediate types of beings, for them we have the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and so forth, through which we are led to liberation. And then those of the highest capacity, beings of highest capacity are given the teachings given in the teachings pertaining to great beings. And therefore, in terms of the sequence of the practice, the 400 verses of Aryadeva says that first avert the non-meritorious actions, in the middle overcome self-grasping, and then in the end destroy all objectification. And so the beings of lower capacity, for them, their goal, temporary goal, is higher rebirth. And for that, there is the practice of avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions. And for in order to do that, we need to overcome the attachment or preoccupation with the pleasures of this life and the pleasures of the next life. We seek the future life and avoid the negative actions and attachment to this life. So with regard to practice of compassion and love, it's even done by Christians. They also seem to have the practice of the 10 virtues in the refraining or restraining the 10 non-virtuous actions, except maybe there's difference in the last, the 10th non-virtuous action, which is wrong view, which could be interpreted according to their different religious traditions. And so for the teaching of the Buddha to become teaching of the Buddha itself, then you take refuge in the three jewels. And so here now we are at... So out of many different commentaries to the Lamrim, the short and the great treatise by Jetsongkhapa, we are now at, we are going through the remaining part of all the Lamrim texts, most of which have been covered in the last 3 years. And so we are now going through Shamar Lamrim, Stages of the Path by Shamar Rinpoche. And regarding these texts, we are at the point which is third, which is showing the result of the practice of 10 virtuous or non-virtuous actions. And so with regard to the... there are three parts to this. First is the result, which is the ripened effect. And so each of the 10 parts of the non-virtuous actions, regarding them, as it was explained earlier regarding the difference in the gravity of the negative actions and so forth, each of these 10 virtuous and non-virtuous actions could also be divided into big, medium, or small, depending on whether you create the karmas constantly or occasionally or sometimes or only doing it only once, and also depending on the big, medium, or small degrees of one's intensity of one's negative afflictive emotions. And so each of the 10 non-virtuous actions can be divided into big, small, medium, or small. And with regard to killing, for example, so killing and so forth, which are big, that these 10 non-virtuous actions, for example, so they could lead one to each of them, or any of them can lead us to hell realm. And then the medium intensity or the range of the negative actions could lead us to hungry ghost, and then the small ones would lead us to be born as animals. So this is relating all the 10 non-virtuous actions for each of these big, medium, or small. So this is what is mentioned in the in Arya Asanga's actual determination of the levels. And then in the Dashabhumika Sutra, the 10 Grounds Sutra, with regard to the second and third, which means the medium strength of the negative actions leading to the hungry ghost and the small ones leading to animal realm, regarding these two, it's mentioned called an otherwise. These are switched around, and so sometimes as a result of our negative actions of killing, for example, even at a very young age, sometimes people die at birth or at very young age, people become very sick, and then they remain sick and frail throughout their life. Sometimes we use the term, oh, that's a luck or by chance, but that's not possible. So maybe from the point of view of some condition, external or internal condition, we may talk about, we may use this term, this is by chance. But basically, because we have to base on the experiences on, the, explain the experiences on the karma, I mean, with regard to karma, if you have created a karma, it doesn't go to waste. If you have, and it will give rise to its effect. And you will not meet with the results of those karmas, I mean, if you have not done them. So this text goes through the different... and then the second point that is touched is the result, which is resembling the cause. So with regard to the deception and being cunning, and then you tell lie. If even this life, if you do these, then people will not trust you. Whereas if you are transparent, honest, and just, then even animals would appreciate you, what you do. And so, regarding this, I mean, the same principle can work in terms of past and future lives. So some of you may have heard this story. When I was young in Lhasa, there are some birds which were kept in cages. And there was I had a parrot. So it had bites others, like sweepers and so forth. When they put insert their finger into the cage, the parrot would bite them and they would bleed very easily. And so, my teacher of writing, calligraphy. And so he was also one of those, one of the party members who one of the members of the search party who came to my native place. So he was known as Nakchu Kempo, who taught me the calligraphy, handwriting. And so he would bring nuts regularly, and then when he used to give those them to the parrot. And so as the days, weeks, months, and years went by, the parrot also began to appreciate and admire the him, Kempo Tamba, my late teacher of calligraphy. And even when the parrot couldn't see him, his body, I mean, but just hear his steps, the parrot became very excited. And then my teacher would offer him nuts, and then he would put his hand inside the cage and pat on the head of this. And sometimes he would even put his, kept his fingers underneath the beaks and hit them very lightly. The parrot would regurgitate the nuts as if it was offering it back to him. And so that was quite a sight to watch, and I became jealous. So because I expected the parrot to respect me like it did, my teacher. And so when I offered nuts, it would just take away the nuts from me, pick it from my hands and just go to the other end of the other side of the cage. And no, there was no response like it did to my teacher. So the parrot also was aware that I didn't mean really to be kind to him, but just to seek his positive response. I was giving those. And then, because he didn't respond to what I expected him to do, one day hit the parrot with a stick. And since then, when I went towards the cage, it would make noise as if indicating and that that person who hit me, who was hurting me, who hurt me, was coming. And so even animals, if you treat them kindly, with sincere heart, then they would also become close to you. If you don't show love and kindness, but be hypocrite with deception and so forth, this will not happen. So this is related with lying, telling lie. And so if you tell lie as a result of it, and being the result which is similar to in experience to the course, this is what is being mentioned here. So sometimes when people are, if you really are sincere to others, people would really appreciate it. But sometimes there are people who take advantage of you, however sincere you may be. In Germany one time, I was invited to some ceremony. And when I was going to the venue in my car on the road, of course, as a human being, I don't need anybody to introduce someone to me as such, because I always consider the other person to be human, like me. And so on the road, en route to that venue, I smiled to a lady who was walking on the side of the road, and that woman, actually, the lady, showed a very strange look to me. And so she showed me a very serious face instead of appreciating my positive gesture. And then I also turned around my head. So my sincere act actually created some suspicion in that lady. And so if you are sincere to others, and then the others would appreciate you. I have many friends around the world, because if you are honest with them, sincere in your heart towards them, then naturally you create more friends. So sometimes some servants of masters, so sometimes certain servants have to suffer scoldings and also all kinds of bad criticisms from their masters and their wife due to this device, the idle talk. So it's it says here that when you meet with all kinds of misfortunes continuously, understand that those are the results of one's negative karmas. And in order to overcome the obstacles to your Dharma practice and so forth, as a prayer, what one should do is avoid negative actions and cultivate the virtue. So, of course, we can actually make prayers. I mean, we may be able to request some lamas for prayers for us, but mainly what the disciples need to do is to cultivate virtue as best they can, and the lamas, on the part of the lama also, those practices should be done, and the disciples' practice is the best way to make offering to this lama. So if you are not motivated by these principles, then doing all kinds of prayers and rituals and so forth so from this we can understand that the avoiding negative actions and cultivating positive ones is the only way to do any kind of rituals and prayers to avert any obstacles. And then with regard to the result, which is similar in in terms of the actions, or in terms of their actions, so it says that the more you are familiar and acquainted with certain thing, the more you have this enthusiasm to engage in them. And similarly, because of killing, what happens is you may be born in lower realms of existence and later come out of it and be born as a human being. And even as a human being, because of the killing in your past life, and killing and so forth, with negative actions. There is this natural tendency in beings to, again, take life, and therefore, so it seems certain actions also give rise to their effects in the form of environments that we live in. And so we go, the text says that we go from lower level to lower level. It's as if with head down. And so that will lead us to lower realms. And so if you are able to understand the significance of law of causality, then the result, which is similar in action to the cause, and it should give you more fear than thinking just thinking about the ripened effects. And so some children, without having relying on others to teach them, they have this very strong tendency to kill anything that they see, like the bugs and like bees and so forth. And some are actually very always very attentive in the stealing others' food remaining or leftover foods and so forth. And some are very called prone to telling lie to others. And so these show how these people are acquainted with these tendencies in their past life. And it's easy to understand that. So His Holiness is making a comment on this last part of this section of which says this is very true. So we'll leave here with regard to this text. So sometimes there is a term, Kutsup Lamrim, which means substitute or representative Lamrim, representative of. So this, the liberation in the palm of your hand is really like a representative of Pabongka Rinpoche and Gyabche Tijang Rinpoche. Day 12, we are on page... it should be page 352. So Gyabche Pabongka Rinpoche gave a short talk to set our motivations, quoting from the works of great Dhammaraja Tsongkhapa, the optimum human birth is difficult to acquire or obtain. This life does not last long. Familiarize the mind with this and turn away from life's trivia. Then after late... you're restating the foregoing headings. He reviewed the material on the sufferings of lower realms, part of the section on the thing about what sort of happiness suffering you will have in your rebirth, next rebirth, in either of the two types of migrations. Such things lead you to want to extract the essence from your opportune life. So with regard to taking refuge, there is a refuge in the context of the lower beings of lower scope, intermediate scope, and great scope. And within the later, there is a refuge within the Mahayana context and also the Sutra context and Tantra. And within Tantra, there is external, internal, and external taking principles of taking refuge. So, in other words, all the methods of our happiness, ultimate, and the temporary seem to come to be encompassed by the practice of taking refuge. So taking refuge, the holy gate for entering the teachings. And this has five sections, the courses on which one's taking refuge depends, what objects to take refuge in, and three, the criterion for taking refuge sufficiently, and four, the benefit of taking refuge, and then the fifth advice after one has taken refuge. And with regard to the courses on which one's taking refuge depends. Our proper taking refuge depends on whether we have within our mind stream the proper courses for taking refuge. These courses are discussed in Losang Chögyi Kelsen's Melodious Laughter of Losang, answers to questions on the whitest altruism of all, which says... It's questions from the pure heart or something like that. The true nature of taking refuge because one is not afraid and because one knows the three jewels are able to protect. This is what you mean, what you meant, Omniscient One. In this praise to the Buddha, it is said that I do not consider the Buddha to be the highest and the best, nor do I consider the Kapila and so forth inferior. No, do I hate this Kapila and so forth, but whoever's teaching is reason-based, and I salute on them. And so, with regards to taking refuge, Buddha in the 70 verses on taking refuge, Buddha Dhamma, by Chandrakirti, it says Buddha Dhamma and Sangha are the objects of refuge for those desiring liberation. And so even Brahma and so forth, who are worldly gods, may be able to help us to a certain degree, but with regards to grasping at some independent self or a true existence, the Buddha showed the means to overcoming that, and therefore he becomes the teacher, and then the path, which is the which comprises the true path and true cessation, becomes the Dharma, and then the Dharma is embodied in those who embody the Dharma is the Sangha, and so these are the three objects of refuge for us. And so the solemnness is on page 54 or 55. So it says that running up the hill and to make offerings in a hurry and so forth, I mean, taking that to be very important is a sign that you don't really have the spirit or the intention or to take refuge in the three jewels that much. So when I once went to Kalu Rinpoche's monastery in Salugara, and then the late Bogar Rinpoche also was there, and Kalu Rinpoche, of course, had passed away a long time before him. And so there was an abbot in Kalu Rinpoche's monastery. So when I visited the temple, inside the temple, there was, and in a very low voice, he said that on the other side is our protector room. So, as I usually say that, of course, in the main assembly hall, we have the Buddha statue. Buddha Shakyamuni is our sole refuge, protector. And he is the one from whom we should seek what we desire. And then this is considered rather less important, but the people who take care of the monasteries, temples, shrines, they consider the Guankang, the protector room, to be more important, and they also have kind of act as if they are very they fear the protectors. Kalu Rinpoche used to tell me that, told me the story. When he, Kalu Rinpoche, when he went to a protector house, the caretaker of that protector house actually made some three prostrations and then took him into that room. So the Buddha is the one who has taught us the real path to lead us out of samsara, but he is considered less important than those of the so-called protectors. Who help avert some obstacles and so forth. And so, It's very important for the monastic institutions where you have study of philosophy to for the students to really take interest in them, in their studies. So sometimes with regard to Kanjuru and Tenjuru, they are considered as scriptures that should be kept on the altar or just to read occasionally for some pujas, and these should actually be used as textbooks for us to study. So, so Nagas and so forth on page 355 on the new edition, the revised edition. Nagas, things, kings, spirits, kings, and others do not have these three qualities: the omniscient love, omniscience, love, and ability. They don't even know when they are going to die. Normally, they are categorized as animals and hungry goats, and their rebirths inferior to ours. No matter how badly off we are still humans. What plan could be worse than this to seek refuge in them? Forget about protecting us from samsara and suffering of the lower realms, or even giving us little temporary help. They may do us great harm instead. So here's a story to illustrate this. A man with a goiter once went to a place haunted by flesh-eating rock spirits, a tax in flesh that these rock spirits paid to other creatures was due. So the spirits removed the man's goiter. Another man with a goiter heard of this and went to them and took refuge in them, hoping for the same result, but the spirits did not destroy his goiter. They made it larger. Similarly, worldly gods and evil spirits are sometimes helpful, sometimes harmful. They can never be trusted. Non-Buddhists make Brahma, Indra, Shiva, Rudra, Ganesha, and so forth their refuge. This is an improvement on the above. Yet, these goats are still not liberated from samsara and the lower realms, so they cannot protect other beings. But Buddha, the teacher of Buddhists, is not like these. A praise to the praiseworthy says, "You proclaimed, 'I am friend to you who are without protection. Your great compassion embraces all beings. Teacher, you have great compassion. You have love.'" You have love. You act by your love. You are diligent. You are not lazy. You, who else could be like you? You are the protector of all sentient beings. You are kind. You are a kind relation to all. So he says, "I'll discuss the Buddhist scholars individually in another section." According to the section, he has three. That section, he has three magnificent qualities: omniscience, love, and ability, or power. Not only do spirit kings and so forth not have even put a portion of these good qualities, but also the sum of the good qualities of worldly refuges. Oh.
We're reading from page number 357. The second para, the reasons why they are fitting objects of refuge. The main reasons are the good qualities of the jewel of Buddha. There are four reasons for this. The first reason, Buddha has freed himself from all dangers. People drowning or trapped in quicksand cannot rescue each other. If the Buddhas, the guides in whom we take refuge, had not freed themselves from all dangers, they could not free others. Buddha, our teacher, is liberated from all dangers. Devadatta once wanted to murder the Buddha and used a mechanical device to hurl rocks at him, yet he could not harm him. In Rajagriha, Ajatashatru let loose Dhanapala and met untamed elephant. All the other arhats are terrified and flew into the sky, but Buddha was not afraid and subdued Dhanapala. A householder named Shariputta devised a plan to throw Buddha into a pit of fire, but Buddha did not come past. Shariputta poisoned Buddha's food, but this did not succeed either. After Phabong Rinpoche had told this story at length, he continued, Shariputta, his wife, and the rest regarded our teacher as a mere ordinary being who could be intimidated by fury, pity, or poison. One can readily compare this with the section on devotion to one's spiritual guide that tells how one cannot be sure of appearances. This indicates that Buddha has freed himself from all danger because he has abandoned the two types of obscurations together with their karmic instincts. The second reason, he is skilled in the means to free others from danger. If he were freed from all personal danger but not skilled enough to know how to protect others, he would be as unable to protect others as a mother with amputated arms is to save her drowning child. But the Bhagavan, the Buddha, is skilled in the means of subduing his disciples. He liberated such great sinners as Angulimala, who was consumed by feelings of hostility, Pramodita, the king of celestial musicians, and Uruvila Kashyapa, who were consumed with pride, and such powerful creatures as the Yaksha Harita and Yaksha Adavaka, such people with dull faculties as Sudapandaka, who benighted ignorance, such people who were old and have few good merits as the householder Sharijada, and such people with great lust as Nanda. That is how skilled Buddha is in means of subduing disciples. The third reason, he reacts compassionately to all without feelings of intimacy or distance. If he did not do this, he would help only those dear to him, not his enemies. Buddha, however, has no feelings of intimacy or distance toward any being. There was no difference in the help he gave and the intimacy he felt towards Devadatta, his own enemy, and Rahula, his own son. Devadatta ate a vast amount of medicinal butter in order to compete, but he could not digest it and became very sick. Buddha, our teacher, freed Devadatta from the illness by swearing that he loved Devadatta and Rahula equally. Shakyamuni Buddha was the Buddha who came to our present world system. If we were to compare, we will see that other Buddhas share the same qualities. The fourth reason, the Buddha works for the sake of all people, whether they have helped him or not. We do not do this. When we gain a little power or wealth, we do not judge the downtrodden worthy enough to hold a conversation with them or say a few kind words to them, let alone help them. We work for the sake of people who have helped us, not the people who have not, so we do not protect the downtrodden. Buddha is not like this. He works for the sake of everyone, whether they have helped him or not.
Reading from page number 359.
The second para, Kyabje Pamangwa Rinpoche spoke in greater detail on how Buddha offered his protection and care for those most unfortunate. Thus, the Buddha has great compassion for all and has no feelings of intimacy or distance. Furthermore, he works for the sake of all, whether they may help him or not. But he loves pathetic wretches especially. If he were not loving or did not have great compassion, he might not offer his protection even when sought. But the Buddha has these qualities, and they say he definitely offers protection even when it is not sought. After this short discussion on the reasons for taking refuge and the beings in whom to take refuge, Gyabje Pabongo Rinpoche continued, the measure of having taken refuge, this third section has four subsections. The first is taking refuge by knowing the good qualities of one's refuge. And this is three, the good qualities of the Buddha, the good qualities of Dharma, the good qualities of the Sangha, the good qualities of Buddha. Buddha has four types of good qualities. The good qualities of his body, his speech, his mind, and his good works. The ornament in realization says his hand and feet are marked by wheels, his tortoise feet. In other words, his body is adorned by 32 signs. The same text also speaks of the sage copper-colored nails, that is, he is also adorned by 80 marks. The signs signify that he is the mind stream of a great personage. The marks indicate the sort of qualities he has inside. It is very powerful to think about the natural qualities of the marks and signs, the good qualities of their causes, and so forth. Nagarjuna's precious garland tells us that if one added up all the merits in the world of Pratigya Buddhas, the learner and no more learner Sharvakas, the world emperors and so on, all this merit will produce a single pore on the body of a Buddha. All the merit needed to produce all the pores of a Buddha multiplied by 100 will produce one of the marks. All the merit needed to produce all the 80 of these marks multiplied by 100 will produce one of these noble signs. The merit needed to produce 30 of these signs multiplied by 1,000 will produce the urna hair curl, which is between the Buddha's eyebrows. The merit needed to produce this last sign multiplied by 100,000 would produce the unisha. The merit to produce this multiplied by a continent produced the Brahma voice of the Buddha. On page number 362, the good qualities of his speech. His speech has 60 nonsense, one tantra says, with fundamental characteristics. Though he may see only one thing, it appears individually to the multitude. Sankhapa, the embodiment of Manjushri, said in his verses on the True One, should all the sentient beings of the world ask him at once to resolve their doubts, he will, in front of each, simultaneously with corresponding bodies and voices in an array, perform the deed of resolving their misconceptions. This means that if various beings ask the Tathagata different questions simultaneously, he would, with one utterance, simultaneously answer all the questions in each being's language and at the level of each one's faculties. Buddha taught the three versions of the perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the long, medium, and brief simultaneously. These three versions came about because of the extensive, medium, and narrow faculties of the disciple. And the next is the good qualities of his mind, where in page number 364, as discussed in more detail in the classics, the good qualities are to be understood as the 21 divisions of the unsullied primal awareness, the 10 powers, the 18 unique qualities, and so forth. People who study and contemplate the classics need to contemplate these extensive teachings in order to derive some benefit. In short, there are two types of good qualities, those that come from omniscience and those that come from love. Because Buddhas are omniscient, even when in meditative absorption on ultimate truths, they are aware of and perceive all knowables as plainly as they would a fruit resting in their hands. One can know this from the priest to the praiseworthy. Bhagavan, all phenomena throughout time, all sources and all places come under the jurisdiction of your mind like a mirror balan in your palm. To all phenomena, mutable or immutable, whether single or multiple, your mind is open without obscuration, like the wind blowing in the sky. Once a Shaya called Nandaka died, the priest summoned the dead man while they performed the funeral rites. The dead man's form manifested. The dead man's form manifested, and the priest gave it food and drink. It behaved just like Nandaka. The man's relatives thought it was really Nandaka, but our teacher told them it was a likeness of the dead man created by the celestial musician. Celestial musician Vichpaka, the Yaksha, Parayana, Sannakama, and so forth. But the relatives did not believe the Buddha, so our teacher invited each of the Shakyas to bring a small packet of grain. Each was to put his household's own identifying mark on his pocket. So many Shakyas offer packets of grain that they will have loaded from an elephant. Buddha identified each one, saying, "This is so and so's," without making a single mistake. This caused everyone to believe. So here we need to draw a distinction. And when it comes to the loving kindness for the ordinary person and those of the enlightened being Buddha, for the ordinary person, it is something related to attachment, which comprise the certain percentage of attachment, and also which aims or look at a limited number of beings. But whereas the Buddha's great compassion, which is being presented in the text, is very different, and it is aimed at all the sentient beings. And when for the ordinary person, when we generate devil of love towards one's friends and families, the reason or the purpose behind is due to being near to that family or friend. And here, when we meditate on the loving kindness and the great compassion, it is not about whether the person is your family or friend, or whether it is your enemy or so on. Your love towards your friends and family is more of an attachment. And every religion, major religions, teach about the importance of compassion. And I think that the teaching of compassion, the compassion that is being taught, is not related or not bound with attachment or desire. When page number 366, the good qualities of its good works, sublime continuum of the great vehicle says, like Indra, the drum clouds Brahma, the sun a precious gem, Tathagatas are like echoes, like space, like the earth. Your contemplation should follow the teaching of this text on these nine similes. The reflection of Indra appears without any dependence on the effect or conceptualization. On the lebis lazuli surface, when the lesser gods see the reflection, they think, "I shall act so as to obtain the same." They will then amass the causes to gain the state of Indra, the lord of the gods. Likewise, when we see the body of Buddha adorned with the marks and signs, we think of gaining such a state and attempt to accumulate the causes for this to happen. These are the good works of the Buddha's body. In the realm of the 33 gods is a great drum named Vega Darin, produced from the gods' merit. Without need of a player, the drum emits sounds that teach the four seals of the Dharma. These sounds stimulate the gods to seek liberation. Buddhas, similarly, without the effort associated with motivation, make their speech extend to all beings, leading them to high rebirth or definite excellence. The good work of enlightened speech is its ability to teach Dharma to suitable fortunate beings. Rain falls from the cloud and the crop grow. and the crops grow. The good works of the enlightened mind are similarly their ability to make the crop of virtue grow in the mindstream of disciples. The miraculous body is revealed in order to subdue sentient beings. The good work of enlightened speech is teaching Dharma. Buddhas perform the good work of enlightened mind in dependence upon undiluted concentration. I think this is to wake you up if someone is sleeping. In short, bodhisattvas on and below the 8th level have to make coarse efforts. The bodhisattvas above this level have to make the subtle motivation. Because of this, their good works do not extend to all sentient beings simultaneously. But the Buddha's good works do not depend on the motivation of thinking. I shall work for the sake of sentient beings or on effort. As an illustration, the moon in the sky has no conception of us, yet its reflection appears on dew, on the tips of blades of grass, and on the surface of water in many hundreds of thousands of containers, provided the water is clear and still. The Buddha's good works take effect spontaneously and effortlessly in the mind streams of disciples when the time is right for them to be tamed. In fact, the cause of the phrase Buddha's good works itself is the primal wisdom truth body acting as an environmental condition. These thus arisen are taken to be one with the Buddha's perfectly pure good qualities. Next is the good qualities of the Dharma. If you have studied the classics, think of the Dharma as the way in which obscurations are abundant as a function of, say, the uninterrupted paths during the path of seeing. We're reading from page number 368. If you do not understand this, think as follows. From where did the Buddhas, who were supposed to have these above-mentioned inconceivable qualities, arise? They arose and will arise in dependence on the realized Dharma, that is, the path of cessation and the like, and on the transmitted Dharma. Think that the Dharma has the quality of producing these Buddhas. One can generally take the jewel of Dharma to be the 10 levels, the 5 paths, and so on. In other words, the truth of cessation and the uninterrupted paths within the paths of seeing and meditation. However, the most important thing is subduing one's own mind stream. So in simple terms, to give you a rough illustration, it is all right to take the Lamrim as the jewel of Dharma. I've already said this. The good qualities of Sangha. Let us take the example of a Sharvaka on the path of accumulation. He was moved to renounce cyclic existence and then enter the path of accumulation. He built up the 13 prerequisites for enlightenment, achieved the first 3 wings of enlightenment, emanated himself for the good of others, received the clairvoyant power, and so on. Sharvakas on the path of perversion have understood the 16 aspects of the 4 truths through fuzzy mental images. Sharvakas on the path of seeing have directly understood emptiness on the path of meditation. I think recently we have a saying that we have a difference between the Mahayana or the Theravada traditions or the lesser vehicle tradition. And we also used to refer to the Bodh Gaya region's practitioners as Theravada tradition. I think it's a big mistake. The bhikshus and the practitioners of the Theravada traditions are, of course, really the great practitioners who have very deep understanding and practice of Vinaya. In Tibet, we have the Mula, the tradition of Mula Sarvastivada traditions, and through the Shandarakshita, the lineage of the monks' ordination came to Tibet, and so therefore maybe the commitments are a little bit lighter compared to the Theravada traditions. Mm-hmm. the Theravada tradition actually have a lesser, a little bit lighter commitments compared to the Mula Sarvastivada tradition. So therefore, in Tibet, when the Adisha gave the initiation, the ordination process in Tibet, he wants to make sure that the monks in Tibet follow the tighter commitment. So therefore, Mula Sarvastivada traditions came to Tibet. And the Mula Sarvastivada tradition has the Pradimoksha Sutra in Sanskrit, and we have 253 commitments and precepts. And for the Theravada tradition, it is around 220 something. Therefore, I have done some research with respect to the four repeats and the 13 remainders and so on. And the third one division is 30 same. But when it comes to the negative, which is the fifth division, has about 180. And I've seen in China the tradition, some have different counting of the precepts. So the foundation is same for all the traditions. The first Lord Buddha himself became an ordained monk, living away his family well-beings and family wealth, and then he established and paid great importance to the promotion of Vinaya tradition. And as we say that wherever the place where there is the practice of the Vinaya traditions, which is called the three principal practices, and Buddha himself has asserted that he felt very comfortable and settled wherever there is the practice of three principal Vinaya practices. And the countries like Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and Cambodia, their practice in terms of Vinaya commitments are very good. I think a few years back in Australia, during one of the conferences called a Parliament in Australia, I also participated in that conference. And I was not able to attend the recent one due to my illness. So I used to attend that conference in Australia. And at that one of those conferences, and two bhikshus from Burma tradition, Burma, came and they wanted to see me. And they were respectful. And I also wore the saffron robe. And they came to my hotel. And initially, the first he said that he is very pleased to see me, and we're all the same follower of the Buddha. And there are some varieties, some differences. And immediately I felt a suspicion in my mind that, of course, in Tibet, the traditions, there are many people saying that the Buddhism in Tibet is actually Lamaism. And it seems those who have the title of Lama or Tulku or the Yogi, and so, and when the Tulkus, so they dissolved, and also when they get married, people even have a good perception of them, and they say it is the noble deeds of the masters and Tulkus. So this thought appeared to my mind, and I told them, of course, there are differences, but there is a common ground for all of us which will bring us all together, which is the Vinaya commitments. And in terms of the 253 precepts and commitments found in the Pradimoksha Sutra, and I explained about that, and they feel very pleased, and they asked me whether in Tibet do you really have those practices of Vinaya commitments and precepts, and I told them, of course we do have, and they are very pleased. And all the Bodhisattva's vows or the Tantra vows ultimately are based on the Pradimoksha vows, which I explained to them. And generally, when we refer to the other traditions as lesser compared to Mahayana, of course, the term is we can find in the ornamental text by Maitreya himself. But generally, when we have, when we use the term the lesser or the Theravada as being a lesser compared to Buddha, then that is a great wrong way of explanation. And the text, the Vinaya text that is found in Theravada tradition, is the basis of all the Buddha's teaching. So these are the foundation and the basis, and based on which we have to promote and practice the six perfections and the ten grounds. So without having the foundation and the basis of the Vinaya tradition that is found in the Theravada traditions, there is no way that we could strengthen or further our practice of the six perfections and the ten grounds. And when we draw a line between, or draw a border between different traditions, and also the Korea and the Chinese, they, since they to the recitation of Wisdom Heart Sutra, which is similar to our Sanskrit traditions, so they, we feel a little bit closer towards them. But in general, then for those who do not consider the Mahayana as not as a teaching of Buddha, so we felt a kind of distant among ourselves. In Tibet, of course, the Vajrayana teaching has prevailed and are commonly and popular in Tibet. I think about 10 years before, someone came to see me, and he said that he went to Tibet and see a monastery called Gyantse Bengo. Of course, he saw the stages of the Buddhas, and really, he was fascinated. But when he went to the protector's dark room, when he saw the tutelary gods and also the protectors with different postures and gestures, he was so frightened he did not fall asleep that night. And so he was asking me, the teachings of Buddha, the Mahayana teachings, which is foundation of the great compassion and love, how come you have such gods and deities with such fierce facial expressions and postures? So therefore, it is very important to have a general understanding of this, the reasons behind that. If we do not have the basis of such a good understanding, then there is a great risk and possibility to generate wrong views towards those traditions. So therefore, I think that that is the reason why for over the years we ourselves stay quite distant from other traditions, which is a big mistake. There are many traditions of Buddhist followers, but we generally feel those who are in the Mahayana traditions, if they feel a little bit distant from the Theravada practitioners, in their mind, if they have such kind of feelings, then it is really very bad and wrong. We will read from page number 370, taking refuge by knowing the differences between the three jewels. There are six types of differences. The difference between the characteristics of the three jewels as follows. Buddhas have the characteristic of complete enlightenment. They starkly and unobstructively perceive the mode of existence of all phenomena, no matter what. One suspects the syllable Jang. In Jangchub, the Tibetan word for enlightenment has the conventional meaning of to train, achieve the most fully developed realization. The Dharma has the characteristic of being the result of a Buddha's coming. When the Buddha turned the will of the Dharma of the Four Truths, his first five disciples develop various realizations in their mind streams, the path of seeing, and so forth. The same happened in other situations. The Sangha has the characteristic of being the practitioners of that Dharma. The difference between the good works of the three jewels is this. The Buddhas teach Dharma by giving the oral transmissions. The good work of the Dharma is different. It causes one to abandon the things one ought to abandon. The Sangha practice the Dharma, and when they gain Dharma's results, others see this and engage in these practices. So those who are the Sangha and those who are not together help one another. This is the good works of the Sangha. They manifestly rejoice in virtue. There are different ways of regarding the three jewels when one takes refuge. To rescue someone from the water, for example, you need a boatman, his leather coracle, and the assistance accompanying him. Similarly, one should regard the Buddhas as objects of one's offering and service, the Dharma as the thing to be met manifest in one's mind stream, and the Sangha as one's true friends. The different practices are the means for putting these three different ways of regarding the three jewels into practice. The different ways of recalling them are to remember the different qualities of three jewels. This is explained in the Sutra on the recollection of the three jewels in the passage beginning, thus the Bhagavan Buddhas. Page number 371. Taking refuge owing to one's beliefs. One's beliefs are the Buddha teaches refuge, the Dharma is the actual refuge, and the Sangha assistant practitioners who take refuge. This is illustrated by different ways in which patients pin their hopes on the doctor, the medicine, and their nurse. If through the process of realization and abandonment, one develops each part of Dharma in one's mind stream, one is freed from every type of danger. Dharma is therefore the true refuge. Taking refuge and not exiting another refuge. In ancient India, Acharya Upasiddhaswamin and his brother were at first both non-Buddhists. The two went to Himalayas to make offerings to Shiva, but they saw the great god Shiva taking refuge in Buddha, so they became Buddhists and great acharyas in the Mahayana. They composed the supreme praise, which tells about the great qualities of Buddha. As this verse says, we have taken refuge in our teacher and our disciples, and our disciples of his teachings, we have taken this refuge for good and cannot exchange it for some other refuge. The dharmas of Bompos, Trikas, and so forth are non-Buddhists and should not be taken as our refuge. There is a difference in superiority between Buddhist and non-Buddhist teachers, their teachings, and other disciples. As the supreme priest says, I have abandoned the other teachers and take refuge in you, O Bhagavan. Why did I do this? Because you have no faults and have good qualities. The more I consider the Tirthika commentaries, the more my mind grows faithful to you, my protector. And praise to the praiseworthy says the same. What should one enter and what should one forsake? What is diluted and what is more purified? So when it comes to the Bon tradition, before the Buddhism came to Tibet, we used to practice the Bon religion, and it is the tradition of Tibet even before the Buddhists came to Tibet. It is an indigenous tradition found in Tibet. I do not have the detailed understanding with respect to the Bon traditions. Of course, every place will have their own religion or practice. And these small traditions, actually, the first is more about praying or praying for the deities and protectors. Then later, during the King Sonzen Gambo, after the King Sonzen Gambo, we can see some critics against the King Sonzen Gambo's writing. We can find in the Bombo text. And later, the greater scholars from Bombo traditions, of course, they also study the Buddhist texts. And nowadays we can find. Nowadays there is a great influence in the Bon tradition from Buddhists. And they also study all the treaties and the texts of Buddhists, and they also debate. So today, the Bon tradition today is very different from the original one. And since the Buddhism flourished in Tibet, they also took the illustrations and reference from Buddhism. Of course, the terminology may be different, but the meaning or the content of the text are much same.
Okay.
Reading from page number 372, the second last para, some people say we like Buddhists, we like Bon, but there is no reason why the Bon teachers, their Dharma or their adherents should be worthy enough to be refugees. The three do not have all the required qualities. The teachers do not have the required qualities, that is having abandoned all faults and so forth. Their Dharma is not even a means of reducing delusions. They claim their Sangha is based on the Pratimoksha vow, but their vows do not have the lineage. One is not a refuge for Buddhists. It is not worthy of being a refuge. All the same, Buddhists and Bumbos say things to each other out of attachment or hostility, and this hardly makes for honest debate. It is vital that you should know the sources of one religion. They are discussed in authentic histories in the writings of past scholars. You must know these things from such works as the Crystal Mirror and Eloquence. In Bon traditions, when they do the ordination process, first they have to generate the awakening mind. And also they seem to have the lineage of the Bhikshuni vows. And I think we need to do a lot of research with respect to that. You must know these things from such works as the Crystal Mirror on Eloquence by Thugyen Dharmavajra. This discusses what the various teachers answered and the sources of all their tenets. Bon teachers, their teachings and views have been corrupted by non-Buddhist meditations and views. They have also plagiarized the Buddhist scriptures. Their false dharmas were invented a very long time ago, and this evil system is now prevalent everywhere. But it is not a fitting refuge for people who yearn for liberation, nor is it trustworthy. With this in mind, Jigden Gumbu said, as for the Bon meditations and philosophical views, in their system there seems to be the system that the universe was born from acts or created by Chadedis, Shiva and so on. These are borrowing from Tirthika views. The history of later Kadamba says, Tirthikas and Bombos soon gain cities. Happy now they later go to the lower realms. Tirthikas and Bombos are like fire. You feel comfortable when somewhat near, but really touch them and you will be burned. Jamilaripa, the Lord of Yogis, says, the source of Bon is perverted Dharma, a creation of Nagas and powerful elementals. It does not take one to the ultimate path. Bon is the most inferior lineage. The difference between Buddhism and outsiders hinges on the refuges. The refuge of Buddhists is the three jewels of non-Buddhists, Brahma and Indra. The fully enlightened Buddha is himself freed from samsara, so is able to liberate others. Reading from page number 374, Captain Pabaka Rinpoche discussed this at length. These days, some people say that Bon Kut, Sherep, and Vega are one with the Buddhist deity Avalokiteshvara. They claim in order that all sentient beings be disciples of Buddhas, many emanations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have appeared among the ranks of the Bumbus. So following the Bon system not only does no harm, but it can only be a good quality. This makes such high-flown claims out of their great blindness. For their mind streams have been affected by evil instincts formed from perverted views. If what they say were so, then it would follow that imitating the actions of dogs and pigs does no harm. It can only be a good quality because it is possible that emanations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have appeared among the animals. People who want the best should completely abandon such nauseating and evil systems, as they will discard the stones they use to wipe their heresies. The only refuge for Buddhists is the three jewels. Buddhists should take refuge purely, and it is vital that they surrender themselves to their refuge.
Kibu
There are two different ways of taking refuge. Merely seeking protection and regarding the three jewels is something that others have achieved in their mindstream. And the special form of refuge regarding the three jewels is something that can be developed in one's own mindstream. And then deciding that one will achieve this. There are ways of taking these two types of refuge in each of the three scopes of the Lamrim. But since we are people who study and contemplate the classics, we must mainly try to take the special form of refuge. However, during a lot of study may not be much help when it comes down to taking refuge. If our taking refuge turns out no different from that of an old, unexceptional person, because our study and contemplation has never turned inward, yet even when we know nothing of the classics, we should have both causes for taking refuge and should surrender ourselves to the three jewels. Here is the way to do so. Think about the way patients entrust themselves to their doctor, medicine and nurses, and their mental state. If you have all the causes for taking refuge and entrust yourself to the three jewels from your heart, you will develop refuge properly in your mindstream. These then are the main things. Without them, nothing will come of the reciting the refuge formula many times and of claiming to be a bodhisattva or knowledge bearer. As the Kadambas of old sage, the elder facing you may not yet have joined the ranks of Buddhists. So whenever to any kind of recitations and prayer, we always need to think about the meaning. The verbal or the speech or the words and the lines are just to remind you about the meaning. The most important is to think about the content. And many a times we stray away but still in the process of doing the recitation and prayer, our minds stray away to different things, which is of not much benefit. Reading from page number 375, the benefits of taking refuge. There are eight of these. You become a Buddhist, you become a candidate for all vows, you will use up obscurations occur from previously accumulated karma. You will easily accumulate a huge amount of merit. You will not be bothered by the harmful actions of humans or creatures. You will not fall to the lower realms. You will effortlessly achieve all your temporary and long-term aims, and you will soon be enlightened. When you take refuge, therefore, don't merely repeat the same words as other people or take refuge only verbally. Take refuge from your heart. You become a Buddhist only when you develop the act of taking refuge properly in your mindstream. Reciting the refuge formula hundreds of thousands of times doesn't make you a Buddhist. People these days say you must recite the refuge formula a number of times. People who instead say you must develop it on your mindstream are rare. In Dhamma, once a monk named Athar was doing a retreat with friends in which they were to recite the refuge formula a number of times. Athar gave proper thought to the meaning behind the taking refuge, and so took a long time. The others were much quicker because they only repeated the words of the refuge formula. They had nearly completed a billion repetitions. Fearing that Athar will not complete the required number, they asked him how many he had done, and Athar said, "Have you only been toting up some number for the refuge formula? So if you recite the formula while keeping your attention on taking refuge, you will be significantly ripened by it." When you take any of the three types of vows, you must precede these by taking refuge. If you do not, you will not receive the vow. Just as the ground supports houses, crops, walls and trees, forests and so on, the act of taking refuge serves as the basis for receiving all vows. You may have committed many karmic actions in the past and accumulated many obscurations. For example, the major heinous crimes, such as when Ajatashatru killed his own father Bimbisara, who had achieved the result of a never returner, or the minor heinous crimes. But when you have taken refuge, You purify such karma and obscurations because you have taken refuge in the Buddha. Thereafter, saying the names of Buddhas or even reading the set of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, one will purify many ancient sins and obscurations. The Sutra Basket speaks of these benefits again and again. The short Perfection of Wisdom Sutra says, if the merit from taking refuge had form, the three realms will be too small to hold it. In other words, the merit accruing from the act of taking refuge is immeasurable. Moreover, the Buddhas are such karmically potent beings that root virtues generated in relation to them will definitely become the causes of one's achieving full enlightenment. Even if this is done without pure motives, from the White Lotus of Compassion Sutra, Ananda, it is like this. Suppose a farmer, householder, has a field that has no stones, nor stumps, or brambles. It has no pebbles or rubble, and has rich topsoil. He plowed it well and prepared it with hand implements. He did right while planting his seed when it was still fresh and fertile. The sun and wind have not been harmful. The seed has not been cracked open, or nor has it been rotted. The seed was planted at the right time in the form of the field. Sometimes it was watered, sometimes it was dry and safeguarded against everything. Ananda, this householder, at some other time goes to the field, stands on the edge of it and says, O seeds, be seeds no longer. O seeds, do not sprout, do not grow. I do not want the fruit. I do not want the rewards. Ananda, what do you think? Would those seeds no longer be seeds because of those words? No, Bhagavan, he replied, no, Sugata. The Buddha said, would the fruit no longer become fruit? Would he reap no rewards? No, Bhagavan, he replied, no, Sugata. Then the Buddha said, Ananda, when people who praise samsari existence, who rejoice in samsari existence, make offering to the Buddhas, even though they may say, by these root virtues, may we never go to nirvana, it is quite impossible that they will never go to nirvana. Ananda, these root virtues generated in relation to the Buddhas will result in nirvana. Although they do not want it, I tell you, these virtues will be transforming until their eventual nirvana. Therefore, whenever one develops root virtues by having a single thought about the Bhagavan Buddha, the fruit of all such roots will be nirvana. I tell you, these root virtues will be transforming until their eventual
Nirvana.
Reading from page number 279, the second para, the King of Single-Pointed Concentration Sutra says, also construct images of victors and recall Shakyamuni, whose primal wisdom is immeasurable. If one grows accustomed to always remembering him, one's thoughts quite automatically turn to him. With cleansed body, speech and mind, always sing praises to the Buddhas. Accustom your mind strength to thoughts like this, and you will see the world's protector day and night. If you are ever ill or unhappy, or met with misery at your death, your recollection of the Buddha will not decline. Feelings of misery will never take this from you. Not only this, but we will also gain optimum human rebirths in all our lives. We will meet with a refuge, and we will never be separated from people who take refuge. And when we train in the ultimate path, we will achieve the three jewels in our own mind stream. Thus we will soon be enlightened. Advice of the one is taking refuge. This has two parts. Advice concerning each of the three jewels in turn. Advice concerning all three in common. This is two subheadings. Advice on what not to do and advice on what to do. The first one is, once you have taken refuge in the Buddha, you should not do things like seeking refuge in worldly gods. There are even now some monks who, if driven to desperation, when things go wrong, all grovel abjectly before the idols of worldly gods. They are a disgrace to Dhamma practitioners. As I have already told you, by taking only two refuges, you cast yourself out of the ranks of Buddhists, because you destroy the refuge vows in your mind stream. All the same, it is all right to offer ritual cakes, perform small purification, make burnt offerings to God, Naga, spirit kings, and so forth. If you merely invoke their help in Dhamma matter, however, you must not take refuge in them. It's like giving someone a bribe and asking them to help you. You don't have to take refuge in them. Reading from page number 381, advice on what to do. Respecting all Buddha's images, even those poorly crafted. Because you have taken refuge in Buddha, then as Nagarjuna's letter tells us, no matter how a Sugata's image is constructed, even of wood, the wise make offerings. In other words, Buddha's image may, for example, be badly made or of poor materials, or those may be many fragments of Buddha images in wayside shrine, but you must still have the attitude that those images are real Buddhas. We have greater faith in images made of brass, gold, or Indian bronze. We put such images in the middle of temples. We have little faith in images made of clay and the like, or in damaged ones, we put them by boundary fences, and later take them to some wayside shrine. But the lamas of the past said that carrying such images out of one's house is like carrying one's merit outside. Also, it is a sign that your faith and respect for three jewels is rotten to the core. If you take the broken bottle of painting and store the center canvas running up when they get old. Respecting even a single letter as if it were the real jewel of Dharma. Since you have taken refuge in the Dharma, you should respect even a single letter N, for example, and if it were the real jewel of Dharma, it is highly damaging. If you do not do this, you will be thick and stupid and so on. In rebirth after rebirth, reading from page number 382, second para, respecting pieces from Sangha members' clothes or even maroon color rags fallen on the ground as you would the people who wore them. Because you have taken refuge in the Sangha, you should show the same respect as you did Gishetomtenpa Rinpoche and Ma Yogi, as did by them. They would not step over a yellow rag, even if it were lying on the pit path. They would shake it out and carry it to a clean place. You should pay as much respect to the pieces from Sangha's members' clothes, or even to maroon or yellow color rags fallen on the ground, as you would to the people who wore them. The Ten Wheels of Kisagarbha Sutra says, even the remains of a Chambaka flower is still much better than other flowers. A monk's ethics may have declined, and he may be a sinner, but he is still superior to all the Tirthikas. Reading from page number 383, advice concerning all three jewels in common. There are six pieces of advice. You should repeatedly take refuge, recalling the good qualities of the three jewels. As I have already said, recall the difference between Buddhist and non-Buddhist teachers and during the teaching. So we will stop here. We stopped on page number 384. Oh, yeah.